Hi, I'm Jason Chung, head of the esports practice at Zuberlawler.
And I'm Philip Milestone, counsel at Zuberlawler. Zuberlawler is a law firm. And like any good lawyers, we have a big disclaimer for you. We are lawyers, but we're not your lawyers.
Until you pay us.
So everything here is for entertainment purposes only.
Again, until you pay us.
Brought to you by virtualtimes.com. Virtualtimes.com, your news from the metaverse.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of What the Meta, the second episode of our illustrious podcast. I'm obviously speaking facetiously. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Jason Chung.
Your other co-host, Philip Milestone.
And this week, I thought we'd go into what makes the world go round. And obviously, people say that's money, but as we know, it's property in a lot of ways. But before we get into that, I thought we'd actually just sort of do a brief recap of what we talked about last time, Philip. And one of the key takeaways I think that we had was that the metaverse is not really as settled as we thought. Isn't that right, Philip?
Yeah, a lot of people are talking about it. A lot of people are interested in it. A lot of people are doing interesting things with concepts around it. But actually being in a metaverse is still, there are high barriers to entry. And then once you're in, there are high barriers to interactivity. So I think, the metaverse is just not in its final form. Certainly, it's a thing where we have the computing power sufficient to make it interesting. But for a bunch of reasons, I don't think it's there yet.
Yeah. And one of the things that we talked about was that everybody thinks it's this VR player ready one, you jump into the metaverse thing. But right now, the conceptions of the metaverse and actually the operationalization of it is pretty basic, right? We do it through a web browser, usually through a keyboard and mouse. And obviously, people are really worried and very happy about where it's going to go in the future and how we're going to interact with it. And we obviously talked about existence and how, you know, that's a negotiated process. And obviously all the meta sapiens here can go back and listen to that. But this week, I thought we'd continue along that vein and talk about concepts such as property and ownership of property, right? Because obviously that's what makes people really interested about the metaverse from a business perspective, right? And I'm sure you can speak more to that. Obviously, the metaverse is exciting and it's getting a lot of development because, yeah, it's cool. But, you know, what do you think the impact of the profit motive is, Philip, on this?
Humanity? I don't know. I feel like Karl Marx probably did a better job at explaining that than I ever could. But as to property, digital property is a really interesting thing. It's not new to the metaverse. Certainly, there are digital assets that already exist. We treat them like property a little bit. There are some interesting struggles happening between digital goods, the way that we deal with real goods. There's some interesting work happening with the UCC and their committees on, I think, future technology. I forget exactly what they're called, but they're wrestling with taking a security interest in a digital asset, be it a cryptocurrency or be it an NFT, and how one perfects an interest in that, right? And that's property, but not real property.
Right.
We certainly have... Go ahead.
Yeah, no. And obviously, we're going to define UCC and everything for everybody listening. But, it is a part of the property regime, which we'll get into. And obviously, it's how we deal with property in the real world is a negotiated process that's been going on for millennia, right? Ever since we created a society, we've been working towards this. And digital ownership is now something that's exciting. And some would say somewhat alien, I guess, but not really. But, you know, obviously, it's different and foreign for reasons that we'll get into. We've got an exciting guest that we'll bring on later on, and we'll intro the guest later, but the guest will talk about a new blockchain-based sort of virtual world platform. And I think the meta sapiens out there will really benefit from that. So why don't we just start by talking about how do we actually buy property in the metaverse right now, Philip? I mean, what is the process? There's a good guide, I think, that, you know, CNBC had really on the step-by-step. You know, how about we go over what, you know, how do you actually buy something, right? So what's the first step to buying property in the metaverse?
The way that we browse on Zillow or Redfin or Craigslist looking for property, right? For the home ownership or even apartment to rent or an office space or anything of the sort, we're going to need that sort of intermediary into a metaverse. Interesting ones that are out there, Decentraland, I think they've hard-coded a finite amount of property in their metaverse. There are others that come to mind where you can jump in and you're just given property. And that's sort of part of the process of signing up, is you're given a piece. And then how cool it is and how big it is and what you can do with it depends on how much you spend in their metaverse. So how does one buy property in the metaverse? I'm going to just pull back on that one. And first off, there's this question of buying property in the metaverse, right? Out here, there's a difference between us and, right? That's a non-controversial statement. I know there are situations where perhaps that's not true, but humans and property are different. In the metaverse, I'm not so sure that's the case. People are not property out here. But in the metaverse, I feel like people can be property to a certain degree, not owned by others, but you can have some of the assets of property where a digital self is not completely controlled by me. It's alienable, right? As opposed to out here where my actual self, my meat space self, I can lease my time. I can give my attention. I can perform services. But no matter what, I sort of get to control me, at least in here, in my brain. In the metaverse, I just think that that's going to be an assumption that we're going to have to rethink, because fundamentally, it's going to be the controller, the processor of the metaverse, that's going to own whatever your digital projection is. And understanding that there's going to be a difference between owning your digital self versus owning your real self is going to be sort of step number one. So that's not sort of buying real property, but it's the question of property that makes me wonder, because out here, I'm confident that I'm not property. But in a metaverse, I'm not confident that I'm not property.
That's actually really interesting because, you know, I think when you look at these guides online about how to buy property in Decentraland or Sandbox, which are a couple of the largest sort of, you know, metaverses or metaverse platforms that are out there, people always start with the physical plot of, you know, digital land, for instance, right? And buying that is relatively straightforward. You know, people always ask me how they do it. I'm like, you know, it's not that hard. You go on, you accept the terms of use, you create an avatar, you look at the listings, you buy a piece of digital land or property, and you connect that to a crypto wallet, right? And you buy it using fiat currency or whatever other process, and you basically just purchase. It's not that much different. The entire purchase of buying sort of land or land equivalent property in the metaverse is not really that different for most people right now. And obviously every platform is a little different. But you come up with something which is really interesting, which is the fact that the concept of what is property, you know, what does that mean, really starts from the self here in the metaverse, right? Like you said, when you're born and in meat space, you're born, you're raised, you are a human being, and you as a legal and, you know, juridical entity can buy things, right? That's how you interact with it. But because it's alienable in the metaverse, right from there, the question of who controls that avatar, how is that in existence negotiated is not, they don't have to acknowledge you as a sovereign person with all the rights, right? They can retract that if they want to and ban you from virtual existence. So that leads to some really interesting questions of what is property, I'm guessing, right, Phil?
Yeah. The same way that Twitter, for example, can boot a user for violating the terms and conditions, you know, the same thing is going to happen in a metaverse, I'm going to guess. And in terms of sort of buying real property out here, a lot of time, energy, and paper making sure that the thing you're buying is what it is and that the record of that ownership sort of goes back on this continent, you know, a couple hundred years before when we started keeping those records in a European style. Versus is different. That property has never been owned before, right? Mm-hmm. And so is there sort of a chain of title we need to worry about? Soon, I would think there's going to be property sold that was pre-owned. And then what? Like, how do you check title on a digital plot? Is there such a thing as sort of like title insurance? I don't even know how that would work, right? Because out here, we understand the risks, which is what we're insuring against. In there, we don't. And that speaks to, again, to property, right? Understanding, like out here, am I in a flood zone? Is this a tornado situation? Is this an earthquake situation? And in the metaverse, how does that play, right? Do we ask ourselves, okay, this digital plot is supported by, you know, this many servers and this many different places on the planet, therefore it's more stable versus that highly volatile property, which though super flashy is subject to attack or supported by sort of half the number of servers, or I mean, who knows, right? I don't even know how to think about the stability of property in the metaverse. Mm-hmm. Because in a sense, it is sort of, it's got a switch. You can turn it off or on, but I think we want the metaverse to in future be like blockchain, where there's not a computer that runs it. There's a network that runs it. so we can rely on it. So how do you buy property in the metaverse? I think what I'm trying to say is there are companies out there now that are trying to force the way we buy property outside the metaverse onto the metaverse. And I feel like that is going to be difficult, right? That's assuming that we're going to use this new technology the way that we've used old technology in that while, but not for long.
I think there's an assumption, especially among non-lawyers, right? That when you talk about property, you're talking about a real thing, like real property, or you're talking about an immovable and, you know, movables and immovables, all that kind of stuff. And you're talking, but you're talking about tangible goods, right? But in reality, that's not the case, right? That's the reason why intellectual property exists. You can own intangible things, right? Because at the end of the day, property is not about the thing in and of itself. It's about your right to control, right? It's about rights. And that's what people, I think, people who are not trained to be lawyers, I think, overlook. It really, at the end of the day, property is useless without the ability to see who owns it. But ownership is really means who can exercise control over it, or more accurately, what they can exclude other people from doing with it, right? And the question is the metaverse mature enough and has the control that's necessary made it over to the metaverse for you to basically create that, you know, property right in the metaverse? You know, is all of this mature enough to basically exist and for us to basically enforce these rights, not only in the metaverse, but also in the real world when we do these kinds of transfers of title and things like that in the metaverse? I don't think we have an exact answer, but like you said, there's a lot of companies really trying to bring the meat space version of property into the metaverse. What's your take on it? How do you feel that it's going so far?
I am not going to be purchasing property in a metaverse anytime soon. And I think that's because of all the reasons you just stated. Is the metaverse mature enough? I mean, no, but I don't think the real world is mature enough for property, right? Because the assumption there is that sort of private property is the way to go. And out here, we have a mix. You know, we have private property, we have public property, and then there's sort of commons and other different shades of property. And right now in the metaverse, I'm waiting for those analogs, right? I feel like we are going to need some sort of commons in the metaverse, because we're going to need ability to sort of traverse between properties, right? Out here, it's a street or a sidewalk, even if it's just the portal where I instantaneously move from one digital property to another. I feel like those portals are hopefully are going to be commonly owned, right? And maintained. And then we've got things like taxes, right? With property taxes and sales taxes when you buy other property. And those go to fund certain goods or certain things that we choose to collectively do, as opposed to things we do individually. Is any of that going to happen? I mean, what is fire protection in the metaverse? Or what's the analog, right? I mean, I'm not going to buy property in the metaverse anytime soon, not because the metaverse isn't mature enough. It's because I really don't think that the structure or the understanding of the risks that we guard against when we interact with property, none of that exists yet. And that happens on a couple different levels. I think number one, I don't think our brains can handle it, right? We're not wired to understand a thing that is infinitely us. We like stability. Like object permanence is something that we have to learn as babies, right? And we get really upset as babies. I mean, this isn't my own experience. I'm a father, but watching a baby freak out when you leave the room is A, terrible. Don't do that to your children. But B, it's hardwired in us to hate things that are impermanent. And the metaverse is just that. It's a giant state of impermanence. And to assume that you can buy property, the most permanent thing of all, right? It's the planet. It's that in the metaverse. I don't think that makes sense yet. I want property to be a different thing. I don't want it to be a bundle of rights. I don't want it to be a right of exclusion. I want it to be essentially a standard, right? The same way that our electricity is a standard voltage. So if I plug into the wall at one house, it's the same as at the other house, right? That's what I think property should be, those standards. And then how we interact on those standards is going to be different.
You know, it's really interesting because obviously the reason why there's so much hype and obviously why we're even doing a podcast on the metaverse and everything like that is because, of course, there's questions about the standards, but there's also giant, giant opportunity, right? I don't know if you know this about me, Philip, but I'm Canadian and I'm also from French Canada, right? So, you know, when I think about property, I think back all the way to, you know, the King of France, yeah. You know, believe in please, Metasapiens, please stay with me on this one, right? I promise it's relevant. You know, historically, when you talk about, you know, how people settle lands, especially in the French system, there was a seigneurial system, and basically everything belonged to a sovereign, right? They would say the king of France, and you had the right to exploit the land on behalf of the king. Right. And they brought you things that you needed, like wives and families. And, you know, there's a lot of horrible stories about that, but they also allowed you to keep a portion of the things that you exploited on that land. Right. Whether that be grains or potato or whatever it is. Right. That process was then negotiated over centuries in North America, in other parts of the world, much longer than that. Right. And it eventually became a negotiated process. And that's how property and real property at the very least became real. And in order to do that, they created standards, they created commons, governance and governments were set up in order to run this kind of system. But obviously, if you didn't get on that boat to the new world, you didn't get to own half the island of Montreal. Right. So do you think that we're at a moment where we're early enough in the metaverse where you could create a standard, which is obviously the thing that Mark Zuckerberg and Meta are betting on, that you could be early enough to create the standard that other people will be able to, say, you know, exercise their rights or help establish the standards on? Are we at that point, or are we still too early? And are people still setting up what our friend Josh Lawler calls metaverse sets, which is basically a bunch of metaverses that all are seeking to interact and leverage each other?
I think we're still in the metaverse set stage. I know that there are big players out there that want to be the only game in town, certainly, but I don't think that they certainly have done that yet, right? They're trying. Metaverse set stage is probably a good thing for all the reasons that you mentioned, right? I mean, some of the reason that we could have sovereigns and feudalism and serfdom and all the bad things that went with it was there wasn't the possibility to create a new France, right? I mean, that was the new world, but there's a history of us walking in and taking land, and it probably not a risk in the metaverse. I mean, maybe, right? I've seen Tron Legacy. I don't know if there's digital natives in the metaverse somewhere. I'm going to assume they're not at the moment. So it's not as if we're walking in there and taking from something that already exists. But I do think that the metaverse sets are also a good thing because it's going to force us towards those standards I was mentioning earlier, right? The same way that you had all these different ways to do a thing. I think the example coming to my mind is gunsmiths, right? That way back in the day, each individual gun was created by an individual smith and the parts weren't interchangeable. And it was sort of difficult to fix and difficult to have. And you had to go back to that smith to get the product again. And along with, and my history is probably wrong on this, but machinery and the Industrial Revolution, it became possible to make objects with interchangeable parts, which we're totally used to, right? I can go to the Napa Auto Parts store and pick up, you know, a muffler for my Honda, and it doesn't matter which muffler I grab from the wall, as long as it's for the right model, I'm good to go, right? So we have these standards. And that is the type of thing that I want to happen with metaverse. I think about it is we all have our own car. We all drive on the same road. You know, they have interchangeable parts. And that's how I want the metaverse to be, that there are roads between universes that we can traverse. This is happening. This isn't just fanciful, right? We've got standards happening with blockchain. Mm-hmm. The way that you can have coins or NFTs on different chains easily, right, is because there are a set of standards that underlie all that. So I think that standards are going to be necessary for us to operate between metaverses. It's possible there will only be one metaverse. I don't want that to be the case because that sounds a lot like your French King example. And we don't do that anymore for obvious reasons. Digital guillotine is what I said when you're talking about French kings. And now I wonder that that's a bad thing. So at the end of the day, we're at a metaverse set stage. And in that sense, we're all minting property, which, you know, goes back to, again, sort of a technology that's younger than the metaverse, but older than the real world. And that's, you know, minting NFTs. We're doing that all the time. And there's a huge fight right now in economy behind who can mint the NFT, who owns it, how do we use meat space rights when applying it to this sort of digital property? And I feel like that's an interplay that is going to be negotiated somehow. But I don't think it's going to follow the model that we've always followed out here. It's going to be different because the medium we're in is different. I mean, ask you the question, how do we solve for rights out here that we want to keep, right? against possibilities in the metaverse that we want to exploit?
Well, that's a loaded question right there, Philip. And I appreciate it, because when I'm thinking about the metaverse, or even metaverse sets, which is the collection of metaverses that may make up a superstructure metaverse, right? Really, anything we do digitally is never spontaneous, right? You can be spontaneously born and gain consciousness in the real world and meet space because we don't really have a say in the matter. But when you enter the metaverse, you don't just wake up there, right? At least now, you create an account, you sign up for it. If you want to buy the current conceptions of digital property in the metaverse, that's not a lengthy process, but it's at least a very conscious process where you have to, you know, engage with the payment platform. You have to engage with the actual platform you want to buy property in, all that kind of stuff, right? There's a number of steps that you have to do before you can access something, right? But there's very little negotiation going on. You're going on somebody else's platform. You are trying to buy property there. Your participation is crucial to their, to just like Facebook was and social media was, your participation is crucial to the growth, but you are a part of the product, but you have very little say because somebody else is creating it for you. Now, my general question to humanity is, as we move on to maybe the next stage of, I don't know. I mean, we can get really trippy about it and think about existing in the virtual realm and maybe uploading consciousness to, you know, AI and things like that in the future. That's a little bit beyond, right? I will leave the quantum computing to the quantum computing folks and our friends there. But when we talk about the metaverse and we talk about building these sort of platforms, if it becomes something where we're doing it as a rite of passage and it becomes normal, I think we will, just like in social media, we will see a lot of more two-way interaction, right? Twitter did have to bow eventually to public pressure at some point. Yes, there was an ethical imperative to do certain things and to step in when people are being, you know, out of bounds with racism or misinformation, but they also had a duty to their shareholders, right? To do that, to protect the brand long-term, right? With the metaverse, is that really going to happen? Are we going to really reach that stage where there are in real life measures that are going to create that dialogue between the people that provide the platform and the people that use the platform? I don't know, because how much control do even moderators exercise on Reddit, for instance? Virtually none, right? But to the average user who gets banned from those subreddits, they exercise more power than God, basically, right? On that platform, but they're not compensated. They're just nameless, faceless people. So I'm not sure is, I think, where I'm at. I would like to think that because we're all thinking of this as the next evolution of interaction, just like social media, that we will have more say on it. But increasingly, it does seem like we do have less say, unless we specifically, as consumers, but also with responsible platform owners, unless there's an explicit process that says, hey, we're going to create that conversation, right? And we are going to actually create a participatory, not a democracy, because it's not, but we're going to at least create a participatory process that people can take part in. But it has to be conscious and it has to be asked for. And I'm not sure with regard to the current versions of the metaverse, whether that conversation is happening. And I'd love to ask our guest about that as well, really, at the end, because I think it's going to be crucial for us to feel like we have any sort of say or ownership. And, you know, really in democracy, you can argue that one person's vote doesn't really matter all that much as well, but at least we feel we have some ownership and some say in how our tax dollars are spent, right? So, you know, hopefully that process really does happen.
I hear you. And I hear you flitting back and forth between paradigms. So you've got the idea of Twitter, right? And you've got terms and conditions where I'm coming at that as a consumer. And then you've got the idea of sort of, you know, French serfdom and its overthrow. And I'm coming to that as a citizen. In those different roles, it's a different conversation, right? Am I agitating for justice on a platform where I'm just another account holder? Or am I advocating for something else in a place where fundamentally, right, I am the source of power, at least in a democracy? Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great place to sort of for us to leave this conversation and talk to our guest about, you know, whether we're comfortable with just having the right to access it and to license the use of our own avatars and our own space in the metaverse, or whether we actually do have a fundamental right to own something if a space has been created to us and has been sold to us. You know, I mean, are we perpetually just pitch the service, or can we exploit it the way we want? I think that's a great place to leave it.
Yeah. And I couldn't agree more. What metaverse do we want? The one where I can port my skins from platform to platform, or one in which I am a token holding voting member of the DAO that runs its fundamentals, and what property looks like in that metaverse?
Absolutely. And obviously this week we're talking about the property and the metaverse, but this is a conversation that we'll continue to have because it's fundamental to what we're doing, and it's going to underpin every other conversation we have, at least for the next little while. So thank you very much, Philip, and we'll move it on to our interview right now.
Hello, MetaSapiens. This is Philip, and we're here with Jason and a very special guest, Charles Smith, Nifty Island. Nifty Island is a brilliant game I encourage you to check out. It is metaverse native, dealing with a fun and exciting way to interact with, well, I'm going to say it, property. And that is because Jason and I, as you know, have been talking about what it means to interact with anything in the metaverse, be it money, intellectual property, be it real property, in the sense digital property can be real. And Nifty Island is an experience where once signed up, you're dropped onto an interesting looking, but otherwise plain island. And you have a lot of ability to manipulate what you're doing. You can terraform it. You can use doors and windows. You can change the light. You can change your own appearance. When I started, I began as an alien. There's a small robotic creature accompanying you everywhere. And Nifty Island is interesting for many, many reasons. But one I'd like to sort of throw out to Charles first is when I joined Nifty Island, I automatically got my island. And I know there are other players in this space, mm-hmm. Decentraland specifically, who are creating digital scarcity in terms of their land. So you made a choice to do something different. As my first question, why make land free in Nifty Island mm-hmm. as opposed to sort of the obvious other choice? And I'll just let you go from there.
Sure. So I kind of see Web3 in general as an experiment in assigning property rights to the internet or to digital goods. And I think we've kind of unlocked this potential of having this form of agreements through smart contracts and tokens, which assign property rights to digital items. And we're all trying to figure out where is it productive to assign them and where is it not. And when it comes to the gaming space, there's been a ton of experiments in assigning digital scarcity and ownership to virtual land. This is something that for me, I see as very much counterproductive. And it's kind of an attempt to recreate scarcity you find in the real world, but it doesn't do so in a way that actually is productive. So like in the real world, there are many examples in which people have property rights over certain things, but those rights are curtailed or they're not extended to things where it would be unproductive to assign them to, right? Like the air is in the commons. The ocean is in the commons. There's reasons that we don't assign property rights to everything. We assign property rights to things in a fairly unlimited way when it is most productive, when someone's going to mix their labor with this item and make it into something better that produces a surplus for everyone else. And so when it comes to game worlds, I see them as fundamentally places that are producing content for people to enjoy. And the way you think of it is it's a lesson that Web2 giants have already learned, which is that if you make these platforms free to use and free to create on, the creative output of the platform is much larger. And what I'm really excited about is assigning property rights to the output, but not to the input, because the land itself is, of course, in practice, infinite. There's no reason why you need a limited amount of digital land. The space can go on forever. And so what you want to do is assign property rights to things that will cause people to produce great content, cool 3D assets that can go on an island, cool NFTs and avatars and music and games that will populate those spaces and make them valuable. So that's really kind of the long and short of it for me is we've discovered new forms of property rights and we're all trying to figure out how is the most productive way to assign them to things. And in my view, there's a lot of wrongheaded experiments in the gaming space. We're trying to do it a different way.
It makes a lot of sense to treat a resource that is as difficult to capture as air, like air, but I mean, calling it a commons, right? The commons, you always end up having a tragedy, right? I mean, the mm-hmm. air is horribly polluted. And the oceans, you know, are in this state where they're horribly polluted. We're now fighting, mm-hmm. you know, wars over oceans. I mean, they're sort of yes. a large chunk of the Western Pacific that a lot of people are very scared about because they're not exactly sure where the lines in the water should be. That's maybe neither here nor there for the purposes of this, but what steps are you taking to promote the purposes you're going for, right? Ownership over output, not input, that will hopefully prevent these tragedies of commons that happen out here?
Yeah. So I think when you look at land rights in the real world, the reason that we assign rights to them is because land is inherently scarce, especially valuable land that's clustered around like key economic sectors. And we assign property rights so that it's well-maintained, just in the way that you're saying you don't want everything to be in the commons because it tends to, you know, it tends to lead to tragedy. And for us, we do not assign property rights to land largely because it just motivates production and it means that there's no cost to creating great content. And beyond that, what we're doing is we're rationing what is inherently scarce, which is attention and server resources. So for us, we look at it and say, in a digital space, the two things, there's really three, maybe three or four things that are inherently scarce. You've got attention, you have tokens or goods that have been just arbitrarily set as scarce. There's transaction throughput and there's server resources. Those are the only real things that are scarce in a digital world. And so for us, we take a couple of those. We say, you know, attention and server resources are something we just have to ration. There's no way around it. They just don't exist in infinite quantities, especially attention is going to be an enduringly finite good. And for us, we will use a sort of scarce commodity, which we haven't really talked about too much publicly yet, but we're going to have a scarce commodity on the platform that allows players to earn a stake, earn the right to access those resources of attention and server resources. So that means if you have this commodity and you stake it, you will have a bigger island. You can host more people concurrently there, and your island will be prioritized in our discover page on our world map. So it really is about rationing what is inherently scarce and driving it towards into the hands of people who will use it productively. That's kind of, to me, what a well-functioning property rights system does.
And that's very interesting, Charles. And one of the things that, you know, I can remember back to is that, you know, when the World Wide Web was really getting going in the 90s and stuff like that, right? Everybody and their mother had a GeoCities page, right? And also, you know, the web search really wasn't advanced at the time. And you had to go through Yahoo, which was a catalog, and find things that way. And it was horribly inefficient. Right. So my question to you is, yes, attention is a very scarce commodity, right? It's not something that you directly control, but you can obviously monetize or assign a property value to it. And you're working on that. But what is the service, or how do people actually bring people to that island? Right. I mean, that's a question I have for you. Like, you can create a great island, but how do you market it? How do you get that attention? Is it really just through assets that you create, or is there an organic way other than the discover page that people will be able to, you know, discover these new spots, basically?
Yeah. So it kind of comes down to three things. One is ensuring there's great content that people are attracted to seeing, much like with YouTube. It comes down to, is there compelling video content people want to view? And in our case, we're giving people tools and easy access to creating great 3D assets, music, environmental effects, game logic that people can enjoy on an island and that will draw them to visit it. And then the kind of step two is like discoverability native to the platform. So on that topic, we have a page that's a little bit like a mix between Instagram's discover page and an MMORPG world map. So the islands on the map are not set in a fixed location. They move based on what we think a user might want to see. And we're going to present people with content that we think will be compelling to them based on the holdings they have in their crypto wallet. So if you have a Bored Ape, perhaps you want to spend most of your time in an archipelago of Bored Ape islands and see other holders. You'll be able to see that, which is sort of like a fractal of the general map. And within these fractals and in the general map itself, your position on the map can be dictated in part by your island holdings. And there'll be some other factors too to sort of ensure there's a churn and that other people are able to rise to the top periodically. So that's the second factor, is good discovery within the game. The third is, how can you draw people in at the top of the funnel from outside of the game world? And with that, we use a sort of deep linking where you have a link to your island. You'll be able to share that on social media and draw people in from other channels. So for me, it comes down to those three things. It's great content, discoverability within the platform, and then an ability for the platform to live in other platforms and pull people out of the sort of public web into these more private spaces, like just like the relationship between Twitter and Discord exists today.
It's fantastic. And I think that's one of the things that most people don't think about when they think about digital property or the metaverse, right? When you're doing that one-to-one comparison, you're thinking about digital plots of land that are static. But what you're talking about is a dynamically curated sort of existence, right? That you can basically, as the platform holder, you can actually generate for the users as well, right? And based on the inputs and stuff. And that's a very different form of property to a certain extent. That's a very different form of existence. And that's something that I think that people might miss in terms of what metaverse platforms can offer, because everybody thinks of movement, everybody thinks of property in a you know, because we have to analogize it to something. And it's very static. But in this case, you're talking about something that's always constantly moving and always constantly curated. And that could add value, right? And I guess that's what you're doing, right, Charles? It's that's what you're going for.
That's right. Yeah, I think in these digital spaces, it's a good time to kind of revisit your foundational assumptions around like why property works the way it does. And in the real world, there's all of these kind of real world constraints that mean that property rights can't live up to our ideal of being a way of assigning ownership over things that people have meaningfully contributed value to, and in a way that doesn't exclude others from producing. So that's like kind of it's almost like Locke's conception of property rights is something that can exist on the internet, but doesn't fully exist in the real world, right? So he kind of theorizes of property as being this thing where in the state of nature, we all live in the wilderness and no one has property over anything. And then some people set about finding some land and mixing their labor with the land, and then they add value to it and it becomes theirs because they're the reason it's valuable. And in his sort of theorizing, he sort of like tries to skirt around or omit the possibility that, you know, maybe people are taking land forcibly, maybe land is itself very scarce, and so someone's claim on it doesn't really come down to the value they've added to it. Maybe the land has value simply because they're squatting on it and it's desired. But in the internet, there's an infinite amount of space for people to create, at least today. And as a result, the only reason something should have value is because people have mixed their labor with it. And so you can think of something like a YouTube account as like very Lockean in nature, and that a YouTube account has zero value on its own, completely zero. And then someone mixes their labor with it and it becomes incredibly valuable. The only strange thing about YouTube accounts is that the service itself doesn't grant a user sovereign control over the YouTube account. They don't let you sell it to someone else easily. You can do it, but you're going outside of the terms of service of the platform. So to me, like, that is something that should be likely remedied, is that, you know, you should be able to mix your labor with an island and make it valuable. And then if you want to pass it on to someone else, you should ultimately be able to do that. But I do think basically the internet's a place where property rights can be assigned in like a more ideal way, where it's more productive and more fair.
Like you said, Locke sidestepped a bunch of problems. Notably, which it was people who looked a lot like Locke who were exactly the ones that he built the structure for. And the analogy here is one needs to be sort of, you know, basically digitally conversant to enjoy the metaverse you're talking about. How do we go about, and should we go about, quite honestly, eliminating sort of those steps ahead that a lot of people haven't taken, right? There are some who choose not to. Let's not talk about them. But in order to avoid the biases and the problems that Locke ran into, how does Nifty Island make itself sort of more universally accessible?
Yeah, I think basically it's largely about removing all barriers to participation. And that's something that takes time. Initially, you'll need some minimum computer specs to run the game. And that's something we want to alleviate over time. And there's a lot of good work being done with things like Google Stadia and other sorts of like cloud streaming services, which should over time make it such that anyone can play a game without really a very intense machine. It should all be done in the cloud. So I think a lot of those like hardware constraints are things that are being rapidly alleviated. And then if you have basically a game where all that's required is an internet access to play it, which I think is in the limit where we'll go, it's not exactly where we are today, but it's where we'll end up, then it's a platform that anyone can participate in. They can should ideally be able to participate in it pseudonymously, create whatever identity they want, and produce and earn money as well by participating in the game economy with no barriers to entry. And so, yeah, I think basically hierarchy and sort of these more like troubled things come from some blockers to participation. And in the end, it should be that good content is rewarded for its own sake. And I think you can approach that ideal on the internet. I'm sure there'll be problems and, you know, constraints that I'm not aware of today. But I think if you can remove all barriers to participation and earning and creation, then you're, you know, maybe 80% of the way there.
You know, my understanding and conception of John Locke and utilitarianism is a lot weaker, I think, than both of yours. But one of the questions that I have that arises from that is, obviously, at the end of the day, you know, the Lockean sort of idea of like you mix your labor with the land and the land is therefore productive and you won't therefore can assert rights to that land. that makes sense, right? And especially in a infinite space like the metaverse, right? But the real question becomes, you know, there are still lords associated with the lands here in the real world, right? And so my question to you, Charles, is what comfort do users have that, you know, in terms of platform, that they're not going to get locked into a non-ideal Lockean system where basically it goes from don't be evil to we now own your soul. Mm-hmm. How you know, what yeah. comfort do they have and how can they basically partake?
Yeah. So I think a pretty enduring constraint that may be alleviated over time, but which for now means there is going to be some central control over any metaverse product, is just that game dev itself and the running of the game has not really changed very much. It's become easier to do it over time, but it still remains a centralized process that exists off chain and actually rewards a pretty immense amount of returns to scale and vertical integration. So if you take Roblox, it's a company of immense scale that has very deliberately vertically integrated across the whole stack. They run their own servers. They don't use AWS and they become a bit of a behemoth. And so the platform standards that they have and the creator economy they manage is very much up to them. I think one step in the right direction that can be made through Web3 is that if the assets that people ascribe value to in these game worlds, whether that's game logic or 3D assets or profile pictures or communities, have some life on chain outside of the game, it gives people a more credible path to exit. So I think like exit is probably the ultimate counterbalance to these sort of like monopolistic outcomes. So there's that. And then I think additionally, like it's possible that games become more decentralized over time. It might be that the game could be hosted in a decentralized way and resemble more of an open protocol. That would kind of put it to rest for good if people had sovereign control over how their island was hosted and it could interface with some discoverability or search functionality that's sort of separated from their individual island. That's possible in the long run, but it will take a good amount of time. I think that'd be an ideal outcome. And I think for now, it's really if the entity is centralized on some level, it has to be governed well. And some of the things I'm more skeptical of are like current approaches to going public as a company, issuing shares in that way, which to me end up creating a pretty relentless and ruthless drive towards short-term profits, which makes it hard to manage a company in like an ethical manner as an open platform. So to me, like I'm more interested in trying to be a good steward of something like that over time, if we're lucky enough to have any, you know, real traction, and then finding alternate paths to putting the platform in the hands of the users over time. So there is an element of like a benevolent, you know, dictatorship that's kind of necessary for any game to get off the ground. And then there's a question of like, will the technology allow us to distribute it to the user over time?
We have this situation, right, where sort of the benevolent dictator, you know, must obtain at the moment because of sort of limited resources to get the game off the ground. But I understand you're also taking steps sort of within game to reduce the centrality of that governance, right? The idea to have, like you said, building communities and let those communities make their decisions. And I'm wondering if the step towards that type of decentralized governance is necessary for a well-functioning metaverse. Like, do you need to invest your users with some measure of control, like one sort of in the analogy being sort of democracy, right? Mm-hmm. Or is a metaverse quite honestly best run where you sort of set the rules and let people play within the rules, but the rules aren't subject to a decision by the group?
Yeah. So I do think in many, many cases, the best governance is no need for governance, right? It's like, where can we just not be in a zero-sum game with one another? Where can we be free to do as we want? And that very much, like just to take it back to our guy, Locke again, like he's making some appeal to some natural rights as to like how things should be managed in a way that just is sort of inherently and objectively fair. And I think that that's like a concept that people might malign or not like, and or be very skeptical of for sometimes good reason. But I do think in general, when you look at how a lot of Web3 and crypto protocols are built, the goal is basically to discover some natural system, which just functions as it does. And people can opt in and decide if they think it's a good system and leave if they don't. The ideal is like a strong right to exit and pretty hard-coded rules. And then there may be some subset of rules that require governance by the user. But I think those are more of an edge case. I think that I think you could have some blend of the two, but if everything had to be voted on all the time, it wouldn't be pleasant, I don't think. And it wouldn't really be good for the user.
Yeah, it can be messy. I feel like the more palatable version was Thoreau's, right? That government is best which governs least. And he was, of course, sitting by Walden Pond thinking about things. He has his own detractors. But if that's the idea, that where you build a pond and we can hang out, And if you don't like it, you know, leave the pawn. There's other pawns. I like it, right? And especially given the chain operability of, I think, the valuable things that you're talking about. Because Nifty Island's idea is you can either make an NFT and use it in the game. And either way, you are welcome to take your ball and go home if it turns out that this isn't the game you want to play.
Absolutely. Yeah, the right to exit is just really fundamental, I think. And it's something that should always be there for all web-based services. And really with these Web3 game worlds, I think a lot of the value will accrue to sort of media tribes or like NFT communities. So it will be that the best game worlds will be the ones that get people who are excited about these new forms of IP to come and create together. And if they govern, if the platform governs itself in a way that is hostile to those participants or isn't to their liking, then they should be able to leave. And I think the nature of the blockchain is such that they will be able to leave. It may just be that it's quite hard to make multiple really compelling platforms to switch between. So there's just certain things we don't know how they're going to play out, but like every reason to want to create a platform that different communities feel at home in and want to create in, you know, so.
And so Charles, what do our Meta Sapiens have to look out for when talking about, you know, the right to exit, to take their ball and go home, right? I'm guessing that you're going to advise people to be careful about what sort of platforms they link up with, mm-hmm. whether it's a closed platform versus an open platform, whether they're prioritizing interoperability, all those kinds mm-hmm. of things. What are some key factors that you would say that would protect users so that they can take their assets and create in this world without, you know, getting locked into a system that they don't want to get into?
Yeah, I would be skeptical of platforms that have that promote some sort of cost where you have to buy in some massive stake into it to participate. Like I think it's a bad model. And I think it's also one that leads to more problems where it becomes really costly to leave a platform. So that'd be one. And then I think for now, the most reasonable expectation is just that you should be able to own assets which have a sovereign existence on chain outside of the game. And you should be able to take those wherever you want. And I think if there's no cost to enter and you can freely bring the assets you care about in and out of the game, then that is like, you know, probably the 80-20. Beyond that, there'll be more like future things. Like I said, like I think eventually it could be that all these games are hosted on some elaborate, like kind of Arweave, IPFS sort of decentralized cloud hosting service. That is something where I'm a little more skeptical of, just like in the near term, like you're just not gonna, it's not on the menu. So it's not really that worth discussing. But I'd say those first two are important.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I just want to be clear on this. It sounds as if a necessary component of Nifty Island as a metaverse being successful is the presence of other metaverses, right? I mean, the right to exit doesn't mean anything unless there's somewhere else to go, which seems sort of contrary, at least to the Web 2.0 idea, which is say, you know, this is the only garden. You want to play here. All those other ones mm-hmm. are terrible, right? Come here. Is that an accurate play? And how does that coincide with sort of, I mean, to be quite blank about it, and building your thing, right?
Mm. Yeah, I think one thing we're trying to do is like kind of promote a sort of like exit, like in a more fractal way within the platform. So one thing is like our game is composed of many sub communities, or it will be over time. We're currently in the process of letting in additional NFT communities. So one thing is, you know, if you don't like the way the Bored Ape community is managed or exists, you can go to the CryptoPunk community and spend more time there. So one thing is that we're kind of focused on a sort of like exit in a more fractal way within the game itself. And then I think as to like the existence of other platforms and stuff, I think it's one of those things that's sort of out of our control. Like if there are multiple compelling platforms, then great. You know, it probably pushes us to do better. We're definitely aspiring to be, you know, as good as we can be. And so I guess that side of it maybe is a little out of our control, but what we can do is give people real control over their experience in our game, let them take their assets elsewhere if they want to. And I think we're just confident that by being an open platform that sort of is planning for future competition that doesn't yet exist, like you're likely to do the right things.
You know, it's really interesting because it really, at the end of the day, it sounds like you're willing to participate in a marketplace of ideas, right? Because ultimately these assets that are being created are not corporeal and they don't have to obey the laws of physics. I mean, you can move them almost instantaneously, right? As opposed to like trying to, anyone who's ever tried to move a car between countries knows how difficult that is just physically and with regulation, right? And so it seems like in your view, and maybe this is a good summation, you're willing to compete and compete on the content that's being created and the utility that's provided by your platform and the ability for, you know, creators to actually come on and play on your platform, right? And you're willing to compete on that because you feel that your idea and your values are going to resonate most with the marketplace. I mean, that's a very noble sort of pursuit. It's completely different, as Philip points out, to the walled garden approach of Web 2.0, how do you feel about that? Just, you know?
Yeah, I think it is both. If it wasn't a winning proposition and it just sounded nice, it wouldn't be worth doing. But my view is that like gaming platforms like Roblox today will be made to look a little bit more like the Soviet Union in comparison to platforms that are more radically open. And I think like giving people robust property rights over their creations, allowing for a secondary market, which is a fundamental part of having effective property rights over something. If you buy a hat in Roblox, you're just burning $20. If you buy a hat in our game, you know, it'll be that though you have a true claim on it, can sell it and move it elsewhere. I think that world is more productive and will win because people will want to spend time there, create content. So I do view it as like the current gaming ecosystems are closer to something like the Soviet Union, and the way Web3 will push it is towards things that are more open market economies. And those tend to be more productive.
So not a zero-sum game, just a more of an explosion of a market, basically is what you're looking forward to.
Exactly.
Perfect.
It's fascinating. And I'd love to have you back. We're going to do an episode on how one interacts with the metaverse best. I've been doing it so far on a 2D, right? My laptop. And we haven't gotten into this, Jason and I rather haven't. But the idea behind headsets or body suits or, you know, is 2D the way to go? I'd like to hear from you next time on what we think is the right way to interact with your immersive game.
That sounds great. I'd love to talk about that.
But thank you so much for being here, Charles. Thanks for explaining to us the purpose behind the game, the purpose behind the rules, how those rules are going to promote sort of the burgeoning flowering of creativity, which we all hope will happen. It's a pleasure to speak with you.